All right, at this point, I will call the meeting to order. My name is Justin Senior. I'm the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid here at the Agency for Healthcare Administration. Carla, if you could please call the roll, see if we have a quorum.
Dr. Armstrong or someone representing the Department of Health? Jennifer Lang?
Hello, yes, you're here.
Here.
I'm sorry, on the phone?
Yes, pediatric supplier?
Department of Health is represented on the phone.
Okay.
Jennifer Lang?
Here.
Anyone representing the Department of Elder Affairs?
Harold Clark.
Thank you.
You're
Hospital
welcome.
Association? Amy Guinan?
Here.
Here. Kathy Moffitt?
Here.
Dr. Richard Thacker?
Here.
Dr. Robert Payne? Stan Whitaker?
Here.
Martha Pierce?
On the phone here.
Thank you. Michael Lockwood? Tracy Inman? Irish Wimbus? Sarah Sequencia?
All right, well, let me go on and move on to the next order of business. The first is that I am supposed to be giving an update of the governor's budget. I'm then going to go through and do a public meeting for a waiver amendment that we have for our 1115 waiver that is going to tweak certain aspects of the waiver that we have in effect with the federal government and give everyone an update on the low-income pool and on the statewide Medicaid managed care program. I will move on then to doing a presentation on the business intelligence unit in our at our agency, which is putting out a series of reports, quarterly reports, that has a lot of great information there that you guys, everybody can go online onto our website. It's publicly available. Look at the reports and get a lot of good insight and data about our program. And then they're going to have we're going to have a try to get to an update of complaints and compliance in the statewide Medicaid managed care program. You have some materials in your packet here at the table on the complaints in recent months, and then hopefully have some time for the MCAC bylaws update and some subpopulation committee updates. Right. Okay, first off, the governor's budget. Since we do have a lot to do today, I will go over it as high level as I can. The key issues for the Medicaid program and for the Agency for Healthcare Administration in the budget is that in 2018, our agency is required to procure a new Medicaid management information system. This is the system that we use to pay our claims. It accepts encounters from managed care organizations, makes payments, capitation payments to the managed care organizations, and it's part of a broader enterprise system that also encompasses our enrollment broker activity, our pharmacy benefits manager contract, and a number of other different contracts, our decision support system and others. We have asked in the budget, and the governor has proposed about $17 million in the budget for that. Only 10% of that is state money. It is matched at a 90-10 rate by the federal government, so it's $1.8 million in general revenue. It is something that we are required to reprocure under Florida's reprocurement laws by around 2018. The complexity of it gives it a very long horizon, and so we have been working with research vendors and project management vendors right as we speak to try to develop the procurement document and prepare to put out the system for bid, either in whole or in some of its component parts, and we're still making those decisions. The governor also has proposed adding $26.6 million additional for graduate medical education in an attempt to support graduate medical education in the state, and also has proposed a study of a prospective payment system for nursing homes. Right now, nursing homes, like inpatient hospital used to be, and like we are now proposing for outpatient hospital, outpatient hospital services and nursing homes are paid on a cost basis. where the entities file cost reports with us. Those cost reports then generate a rate based on what the allowable costs were. They're then subject to audit and auditors and all of this back channel stuff, often years after the fact. It doesn't fit well with the way that we pay for nursing home services anymore and the way that we pay for outpatient services anymore, because we do it in a capitated environment. And so we are seeking to have prospective payment systems for nursing homes and for outpatient, and what the governor has put with respect to nursing homes in his budget is money for a study where we would look at the various prospective payment systems that can be used for nursing homes, make some design decisions, make the decision about what type of system fits our program the best, and make recommendations to the legislature about how to shift to a prospective payment system. In the inpatient setting, the way that it worked was we did a study for a year. That study resulted in recommendations to the legislature, and it was the year after that that we actually implemented the system, the inpatient hospitalization prospective payment system. We have just finished the study on the outpatient side and hope to, sometime at the end of this calendar year, implement a prospective payment system for outpatient, and now we're going to try to do the same thing with nursing homes, where we study it for a year, make recommendations about what the system should look like, and move forward from there with a prospective payment system for nursing homes. Those are the high-level highlights of the governor's budget. Are there any questions from the committee about the governor's budget?
Justin, I had a question.
Yes.
Dr. Thacker, just in regards to graduate medical education and the amount that you mentioned, is that a decrease from last year?
No, those are additional monies over and above what was in the budget last year. Most of what was in the budget is recurring, and so this is adding to the amount of money in the budget to support graduate medical education.
Very good. That's great to hear. Thanks.
Okay. With that, I'm going to move on to an update on the statewide Medicaid managed care program. You have it in the packet in front of you. It's this one. And the first part of it is an amendment request, my description of an amendment request for Florida's 1115 Managed Medical Assistance Waiver. We operate our program, and all states operate their Medicaid programs pursuant to an agreement with the federal government. Ours takes the form, by and large, of an 1115 waiver. That's named after the section of the Social Security Act where the Secretary of Health and Human Services granted us a waiver in our program design, and we reached an agreement about how to design our program. The special terms and conditions of that waiver are available online. If anybody has any trouble finding them, we can direct you to where they are. We have sought to amend our program in certain key ways, and the amendment process is part of that. We're supposed to hold public meetings in two geographic areas of the state, at least. And so this one here in Tallahassee, this is the first public meeting on the 1115 waiver. There will be another one later this week in Tampa, because the two meetings do have to be in separate geographic areas. To make sure we understand who is in the room for this public meeting, there is a sign-in sheet as you come in, and if you can sign in and include your email address, we will make sure that you're added to our interested parties list. And the purpose of this portion of the meeting is to get some public comment regarding the proposed amendments to our 1115 waiver, which is the one that authorizes, like I said, our managed medical assistance program. This meeting is going to be a listening session. I'll give you a brief presentation regarding the program and what we are proposing, and then I'm going to open the floor up to public comment on the amendment only. Try to limit your comments at this point to the proposed amendments. If you would like to speak during the public comment period, if you could indicate on the sign-in sheet, or if you did indicate on the sign-in sheet, that's great. I think it's small enough of a group where, at least in the room, if you'd like to speak up, you can just raise your hand. We'll recognize you, and you can give your public comment. We'll make sure that your comments are forwarded to the federal government, and then we will open it up for people on the phone as well if they have any comments. Okay. Now, if you would like, there are also comment forms that are available at the entrance, which would allow you to submit a comment in writing, either here today or through email or mail. There is information on the email address, website address, and physical mailing address where you can send those comment forms. I think Millie's going to go get them now. And we would encourage everybody to get the comment form, fill one out, if you would like to make a comment on the proposed amendments. Now, our 1115 waiver is an agreement that lasts for roughly 3 years, and it is scheduled to expire at this point on July the 1st of 2018, if I'm not mistaken. No, actually 17. It is something that we do intend to renew, but right now the expiration date is on June 30th of 2017. And there is a process and a protocol in the special terms and conditions that tells us how we are to obtain an amendment and what types of changes to the program require an amendment. The types of changes that require CMS approval are changes to eligibility, enrollment, benefits, enrollee rights, delivery systems, cost sharing, the evaluation design, the low-income pool, any sources of non-federal share of funding, budget neutrality, and other comparable program and budget elements. You can see the on the next slide, which is slide 9, the federal waiver amendment requirements. We do publish for public notice 30 days prior to submitting the waiver amendment request. The fact that we are going to file one, we also notify the Native American tribes in the state, and the public notice document is available, and you can see we'll insert a link there for you. Here's the long and the short of what we're trying to do. They are tweaks to the program. Right now, we have a hemophilia program that pays for hemophilia factor drugs for our recipients outside of the Medicaid managed care program. It's done on a fee-for-service basis. It's not a service that's covered by the managed care plans. We have authority to have up to two companies under contract to provide those services. We would like to amend the waiver to allow us the flexibility to offer up to three companies. It's not something that we're trying to carve in, but we just want a little extra flexibility and have perhaps more choice for recipients. So we're seeking to add to the ability to have up to either one to three vendors as opposed to one or two. We also are trying to amend the waiver to include payment in the MMA capitation rates for nursing facility services for children under the age of 18. And this does add a covered service to the program. There are reasons why we do it. It is very unclear from the statewide Medicaid managed care statute what happens with pediatric nursing home services. It's very clear in the long-term care waiver, which applies to those 18 and over, that nursing home services are a covered service. And then when you look at the MMA portion of the statute, it's very specific about what types of services are carved out and what types of services are carved in, except for nursing home services. For those under the age of 18, those are not mentioned as a carve-out service, and they're not mentioned as a carved-in service. Having looked at the statute initially as we rolled the program out, we left those services out. That creates a dynamic that is not particularly ideal. When you don't have the incentives in your program correctly set, then you have to watch your program very closely. And as it stands right now, if a managed care plan does not want to have a child in their program, they could put them in a nursing home. They would end up in a fee-for-service environment and outside of the managed care plan's essentially payment purview. That is a bad incentive. We do not want children to be placed into nursing facilities. And so we want the managed care companies to have the nursing home costs built into their capitation rates so that they and that service to be covered by the managed care plan so that they don't have that incentive. And in fact, their incentive would be to serve that child in the least expensive setting, which is almost always the home and community-based setting of that child. This does not affect a very large number of people in the state of Florida. We have less than 150 children in the state that are in nursing homes at any given time. Often they're in there for very short periods until a plan of care can be established in their home. Sometimes they're there because they're briefly in the custody of the Department of Children and Families and they have intense medical needs. But it's usually a temporary setting. There's usually fewer than 150 at any given time, and we want to make sure that it either stays that way or even that number might be driven a little bit lower over the course of the next few years. So that is that portion of the amendment. The last thing that we're seeking to amend is as we designed our managed medical assistance program, we wanted to require, because we felt like they were areas of focus in our program, we wanted to require the plans to have performance projects where they are trying to drive to higher quality performance and higher performance in a certain number of areas. Two that we made mandatory were early care in the first 15 months of life and pregnancy. So prenatal care, postpartum care, and the care for the child in the first 15 months of life, all of the plans are required to have a performance project around that. The other is pediatric dentistry. All of the plans are required to have a performance project around pediatric dentistry. As we designed the waiver and required those programs and those performance projects, we did not know what types of specialty plans we would be getting in the program and what types of bids we'd get in the competitive procurement. As it turns out, some of the plans that bid specialties that really don't meet up with the idea that someone is going to be having children in the plan or that there would be children at all. For example, Freedom, which is one of our specialty plans, is a specialty plan for Medicare, Medicaid, dual eligibles with chronic conditions. And there just aren't any births and not any kids in that program, and yet we have a waiver that requires them to have a performance project around pediatric dentistry and as well as around the birth process. So we want to make sure that we can change that just for the specialty plans to allow specialty plans that really don't have a very significant pediatric population and don't have very many births in their plan. We want to have them with performance projects that are very specific to the specialty population that they're trying to serve and have that flexibility. So those are the changes to the amendment. And with that, I think I'm going to open it up to public comment. There will be another meeting, like I said, in Tampa on January the 21st from 1 to 2:30 p.m. You can see the address for that in the materials. With that, I will open the floor for public comment. I'll start with the people on the committee. Any questions or comments? Dr. Payne, welcome.
Robert Payne. Just one. It all makes perfect sense to me. The only thing I question is, if you're going to open up the hemophilia program to go between 1 and 2 to 1 and 3, why stop at 3? Why don't you have more than 3?
That's a good question. I think that the idea is that there would be a limited number of choices, but we wanted there to be more than there are right now. There are a couple of different ways that have been pitched to us as how we could design and deliver those services, and we wanted to open up the bidding so that we could get more strategies, if you will, and how to deliver those services. It's certainly something we'll take under consideration, that maybe it could be more than that, and something that we will take into consideration as we talk to the federal government, and we'll certainly pass that comment on to the federal government as we discuss it with them.
Why stop at 3?
Yeah.
Yes.
Dr. Thacker, you're recognized.
Yeah, Dr. Thacker, so to kind of follow up with Dr. Payne's question, and I may not understand all of the particular issues on that, but I have served on the Medicaid Pharmacy and Therapeutics Board. And so in the process of contracting with vendors, sometimes that's part of the deal, is to have an exclusive contract or only allow one other competitor. And so it may turn, I'm for having more options, obviously, but sometimes you get locked into those competitive bids where either they want an exclusive deal in order to get the best product and the best price, or potentially only one other vendor. So,
yeah. That definitely is what is playing into our thinking. It's possible that someone could offer us a discount in exchange for all of the business or volume, and we'd have to weigh that against the possibility of splitting the business up and having different delivery strategies and what's best for the consumer in the state. So it will be a best value procurement. That's the way we would do it, and we'll see what the different approaches are, and we'll make sure that those comments are passed on to the federal government. I'll now open it up to the folks in the room. Anybody wishing to make a public comment? Do we have cards put in, anything like that? Chris Snow, you're recognized. Let's just, if you could just wait a second, we will have a microphone we can make available to you.
Chris Snow, representing Alliance of Florida PPEX. The second item, Justin, where the nursing homes being brought into the rate for the children, do you anticipate any negative or positive impacts on the PPEC service? as are those children maybe possibly could moved into a PPEC? Or are they, instead of nursing, since you know, you said there'd be an incentive for them to pull them out of the nursing home?
That's difficult to predict.
Okay.
We have had amendments in the past that specifically apply to prescribe pediatric extended care. These amendments are not directed towards PPEC services. If whether or not they have an indirect impact, I suppose that's certainly a possibility if the plans are working to get these kids out of the nursing facilities and into home and community-based settings. It's possible that some of the hours of the day could be taken up by PPECs providing the services. Be hard for me to predict that. Any additional people in the room wishing to make a comment? Amy Guinan, you're recognized.
Hi. So I just realized I did have a question following up on Mr. Snow's question. I just wanted to make sure I understood with the nursing facility services. Right now, those children aren't excluded from managed care. It's just that the reimbursement has been fee-for-service, right? So many of these children may already be enrolled in a managed care plan?
It's quite possible that they are enrolled in a managed care plan, but when you're in a nursing facility, there's a very significant bundle of services that they're receiving from the nursing facility, and so you're not going to see a lot of claims out on the managed care side and a lot of encounters coming into our system. Things like physician services, nursing services, pharmacy services, those are all going to be covered at the facility.
Right.
And so the concern that we would have is that a managed care plan that had home supports in place for a child and was spending significant amounts of money on home health and perhaps PPEC services, although that's actually a carved-out service, but home health and transportation and physician services and pharmacy services, we have not seen this happen. Again, our numbers are extremely low, but we have to watch it every month and watch the numbers because of the way the incentives are set up, out of concern that a managed care plan might want to place a child in a nursing facility so that they don't have to put that full benefit package in place in the home setting.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks.
To their credit, they haven't done it yet. I haven't seen it, but when you don't have the incentives right, you have to then have someone watch it. Any additional questions in the room or comments? Seeing none, I will ask the operator and the people on the phone to begin the question and comment period. Do we have an operator? My note said there was an operator.
They asked for not one.
Okay. All right, going once.
I have a question.
Okay, here we go. Who's that?
This is Blanche. I work for University of Marai, and I wanted to know, it's really kind of a nonchalant question, the information that you're giving us right now, is that all on the website or on a slide or a presentation or anything like that?
It is available in a presentation. It is available in a link on our website, and there will also be an additional public meeting down in Tampa where these materials will be presented again. If you want
yeah,
to...
Yeah, but it's not feasible for me to travel to Tampa, so...
Sure. You could call into that one
so
as well.
I'm on the link right now, and I just didn't know where the information that you're advising us to go to. Would there be an email sent to us to let us know where exactly each thing is, or is just all on the ACA website?
If you provide us your email address, we can get you the information that allows you to access the link. Would you like to provide it now?
Okay, not a problem.
You could email us your email address. Is that going to be fine?
Yeah, I can do that. Not a problem.
Okay. You know where to reach us?
I do have it here, I'm sure. When you sent me the confirmation.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you have any trouble, it's justin.senior@ahca.myflorida.com.
Okay.
Okay. Any additional questions or comments from people on the phone?
Hi, Justin. This is Lori Howell with Option Care.
Hi.
And I have a question. the two companies that currently have the competitive or the bid for hemophilia, I understand it's CVS Caremark and Quorum. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you consider that two companies or one, since they Quorum is now owned by CVS?
Yeah, it's essentially one, although I think operationally they're still different. But you're right, it is one company. Our current waiver does not require two. It could be one or two. So when they did merge, it didn't make much of a difference from an authority perspective, but it may make a difference ultimately from a choice perspective, and it is something that we're watching.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions or comments on the phone? All right. Hearing none, that concludes the public comment period, and it concludes the portion of the presentation that is associated with the public meeting for the 11:15 waiver. Thank you all for that. If you have any written comments, again, you can write them down on one of the comment cards and submit them to us, and we'll make sure that those comments are forwarded on to the federal government. Okay. With that, a lot of people here to listen, probably to the hemophilia would be my guess. It's definitely a program worth a couple $100 million, so it is probably one that draws a lot of interest from around the state, hemophilia treatment centers as well as some pharmacies, so that's to be expected. Next up is an update of the statewide Medicaid managed care program. As you probably are all aware, we now serve most of the Medicaid recipients in the program, most of the enrollees, through health plans that are under contract with our agency that provide services. Stan, you're recognized. I'm going to go to the low-income pool in just a second. It's part of this presentation because it's part of the same waiver that creates the statewide Medicaid managed care program. It is also of interest to a lot of hospitals around the state. Just starting off again with the statewide Medicaid managed care program, we're starting to get in some of the first data around the program and some of the successes and some of the trouble spots that we have in the program that we're committed to working on and continuous improvement. But before I get to that, I will start with the low-income pool. As part of last year's negotiations with the federal government, we were able to secure a two-year-only extension of the low-income pool. Going forward, the low-income pool in the upcoming fiscal year, starting on July 1st of this year, the low-income pool is going to be $608 million, roughly, total computable. About 40% of that is going to be from local funds put up by hospital systems and put up by local governments, and the remainder is going to be the federal match on those local hospital dollars. The funds and the new wrinkle that we have to this $608 million is that the state has the option of splitting the $608 million between medical schools and hospitals, or providing it simply to hospitals, or providing it only to medical schools. Those are the three options. You could do one or the other or both. And the $608 million is to be distributed to hospitals who are going to be tiered, and there could be up to four different tiers. And the hospitals that receive the highest reimbursement from the pool will be the ones that have the highest ratio of charity care in relationship to commercial payers. An example would be that the legislature and the governor could decide in the final budget to split the industry up into two tiers, and the first tier would have 100% of its charity care paid for in the year in question, and they would there would maybe be 14, the ratio would be set, and maybe only 10 or 14 hospitals would be in tier one. The remainder would have a smaller percentage set, but they'd all have to have an equal percentage of their charity care paid for. The year that we look at for charity care, or we look back at the cost reports, and we could choose either 2013 as the year that the hospital provided charity care, and that would be the amount that the hospital could be reimbursed, or 2014 would be the year the charity care amount. That would be kind of the limit that the hospital hospital would have on the amount of charity care that they could have reimbursed. That is new. In the past, the people that the entities that gave local dollars to the low-income pool had a guarantee that they would get the local dollars back plus an additional at least 8.5%. That is no longer the case. So the hospitals that contribute and the local governments and taxing districts that contribute to this are going to have to take a look at it, look at the charity care that their local hospital provides, and be relatively they're going to have to feel relatively safe that if they give money to the low-income pool that they are going to realize more money back in return, or they won't contribute in the first place. So that is going to be the trick here. But there are lots of design elements that the legislature can choose to incorporate into it. Those are listed on slide, I believe it's slide 20, which tells you, you can see the bullet points on slide 20, all of the different decision points that need to be made by the legislature in conjunction with the governor in the final budget as to what the low-income pool design should be. The governor himself, in his budget, did include a design that called for it to go to hospitals and that divided the hospitals, I want to say, up into three tiers for distribution of the funds. And with that, are there any questions on the low-income pool? Stan.
Yes, this is Stan Whitaker. When you're talking about charity care, are we looking at percentage of overall care or dollar amount of overall care?
They're really looking at a dollar amount, and what they're looking at is the amount of charity care that the hospital provided. And charity care has a fairly specific definition, as the feds described it. Charity care is care that a hospital renders with no expectation of being paid. It is not bad debt. And most hospitals do have charity care programs where they provide care and they render services under conditions where they do not expect to have payment and they don't seek payment or try to collect payment. Those are the charges or the costs that could be used in this calculation. It's very important from a data manipulation standpoint. This is the reason why the federal government said we had to choose a past year to determine the amount of charity care, because at the time that the hospital submitted those cost reports and listed their charity care on their cost reports, they had no idea that if they had listed more, they would have had a benefit from the low-income pool in 2016 and 17. That's why we're using past years to determine the amount of charity care, and that charity care is then compared to how much commercial payment the hospital receives. Not overall payment, but commercial payment, with the idea being that the hospitals that have the highest percentage of commercial payers have the greatest ability to shift the cost to those commercial payers to offset the cost of the charity care. But the ones that have the lowest levels of commercial payment and the highest levels of charity care are the ones that should be the focus of the low-income pool.
So such as critical access hospitals that are in situations where you have high areas of need where you have low reimbursement or primarily Medicaid participants within the facility, and mm-hmm. you lose quite a bit of care there, they lose a lot as far as percentage of income. It's much higher. As per dollar amount for charity care, it's much lower. So when you have a hospital that has, you know, $100,000 worth of charity care and they still make a $1 million profit, as opposed to a critical access hospital that loses $50 million worth of charity care, you know, and can barely scrape by, has no profit margin at all.
As we ran models, most of the large safety nets did end up near the top when you looked at their ratios in terms of they had the highest ratio of charity care and the lowest amount of commercial care. Number of rurals also made it into that. And so it does seem like there was some discussion with the federal government about whether we could make Tier 1 comprised of rural hospitals or teaching hospitals. But the way that they described it, And the way that they set out the parameters, they refused our request to do that. The federal government did, it's fair to say. But at the same time, the way that they asked us to do it still did tend to lead to results where the teaching hospitals and the safety net hospitals, some of the rural hospitals, ended up near the top. You mentioned Medicaid. One thing that the low-income pool really has nothing to do with anymore is Medicaid. Medicaid patients are not charity care cases.
Right.
And so we're not looking at Medicaid patients, and the patients that would be served in a charity care program are not Medicaid eligible.
Okay.
Any additional questions about the low income pool?
So when they're making it, when you're the priority for making up these tiers again is the number of the dollar amount of charity care, percentage of charity care, and
yeah, you're looking at the amount dollar amount of charity care that the hospital provides, mm-hmm. and comparing that to the dollar amount of commercial that the hospital pulls in, commercial payers.
Okay.
Yep, and then you're creating a ratio out of that, and the ones with the highest ratio of charity care are going to be, you're going to be rank ordered with the, from the highest to the lowest.
Okay.
And at that point, there's 200 and something hospitals in the state. The legislature and the governor need to come up, where's the line for where tier one is? And then what percentage of your charity care, of those hospitals' charity care, should be paid out of the $608 million? And then you go to how many other tiers you want. Do you want two? Do you want three? Do you want four? With each one, maybe tier two, where do you draw the line for tier two? And do they get, what, 25% of their care paid for, 50%? I mean, those are the decisions that have to be made until the $608 million essentially is exhausted. And
okay, I got you.
And again, a hospital can look at its numbers, and a local government can look at its numbers, and it's possible that certain donors from the past, as they look at their numbers, they would realize that if they donated the same amount that they did before, there is no way they would get that much back in return. And so they may be reducing or changing the amount of money that they're giving over past years. It's certainly a smaller pool, so we would expect everybody to donate a little bit less. But there, it could be that some hospital systems and some local taxing districts and local governments decide that it's not worth it for them, and they're going to pull their money off the table, keep their state share, because they'll get more keeping their state share than they would if they put it up. There's no guaranteed return. Dr. Thacker.
So there can be a network of hospitals, right? And so when that ratio is calculated, is it for each individual hospital, or would a network of hospitals or a group or a division of hospitals get together and turn in numbers?
Yeah. There's no HCA would be an example. There's a number of HCA hospitals around the state. Each individual HCA hospital is looked at separately in the way that we ran the numbers.
Same with Broward. You know,
that's right. There's a Memorial
system,
Hospital West, yeah. And exactly.
Right.
And some of those facilities end up in Tier 1, and some of them did not, you know, as in some of the models we ran, depending on where we drew the line. Any additional questions about the low-income pool? Okay. So next year does figure to be the last year of the pool, and then after that, it will not be a feature of the Medicaid program. And as it stands next year, it won't be money that will be used for serving Medicaid patients anyway. Okay. Now, next up.
Justin, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Justin, this is Blanche again, University of Hawaii. What is your email address, Justin, again?
It's justin.senior, S-E-N-I-O-R, at ahca.myflorida.com.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, turning to slide 21. As I said before, we are starting to get some initial quality reports in on the statewide Medicaid managed care program. These are things that we're going to be watching closely over the course of the coming years. It is our expectation that when we look at national quality benchmarks, that our program perform at or above the national average in all of the measures that we track. As we created measures that we were going to use to track the quality in the program, we did our best to try to come up with the federal government in our 1115 waiver negotiations with a shared definition of success. The federal government over the last few years has put out what it regards to be core quality measures for adults in the Medicaid program and core quality measures for children in the Medicaid program, and we by and large have adopted those core quality measures as the measures that our managed care program is supposed to meet and that our health plans are supposed to meet. They are derived from HEDIS scores. There are a very prominent element of our program. They are scores that look at, for example, if you have a diabetic patient, you'd expect that patient to receive certain types of healthcare encounters and tests and have interventions during the course of a year. If they were getting appropriate care, you would not expect them to be showing up at the emergency department to get their care. And a HEDIS score is, it looks at the number of people in a plan that have a certain diagnosis like diabetes, and then looks at the percentage of people with diabetes in that plan that got the type of test or the type of medical treatment or the type of preventive service that you'd expect them to receive during the course of the year. That percentage then can be compared to a national average. It can be compared to a statewide average. It could be compared across lines of business. Almost 90%, over 90%, I think, of health plans in the country participate in this process, which is done by NCQA. And so you really do get an idea of how you stack up and compare to other payers and systems. We also look at the consumer satisfaction in our program. We want the consumers that go in, the enrollees that go in, to be satisfied with their care. We want them to feel like when they call the helpline of their health plan that they're getting the help that they need and the questions answered that they need answered. And we want them to report to us that they are very happy with the health care that they're receiving and with their health plan. And finally, we have developed ourselves some report cards on our plans that look at key delivery systems in our program based on our population that allow people as they come into our program to comparison shop health plans based on things that are important to them. There's a grade, for example, on pregnancy-related care. So if you've gained eligibility to the Medicaid program by virtue of pregnancy, you actually can compare the plans in your region with respect to how well they connect pregnant women with the services they need during the course of their pregnancy. And we are trying to make those particular report cards a little bit more prominent, a more prominent feature in our choice process and a more prominent feature in our program in the coming year. Would certainly welcome ideas from the committee and from the public on how to get the word out there about those and how to make them a little bit more user-friendly and understandable. We have a number of different ways of looking at quality, and if you turn to the next page, you can look at our complaints. The HEDIS scores and the CAHPS surveys are done on an annual basis and kind of give you a look at what the year looked like with respect to consumer satisfaction and with respect to access. But on an ongoing basis, one of the ways, one of the chief ways that we monitor our program is through the Complaint Hub. There's going to be a more full presentation, if we have the time, on our Complaint Hub and our complaint numbers for the committee a little bit later on. But as you look at it, you can see that we can track our numbers over time. And you can see going back in the chart on page 22, you can see that we've been tracking the total number of complaints that we've had starting in August of 2014 and going through November of 2015. August of 2014, August the 1st, was the date that the program was rolled out statewide. So that was the first month of implementation. You can see we then had a decline in the number of complaints. It started to rise a little bit into the summer of 2015, and recently it's been coming down again. It's a relatively low level of complaints, but as I'll show you on the next slide, there are a lot of different ways that you can slice the data and look at the data that gives us a little bit more insight into our program. And so if you look at the next page, you can see that not only do we get the total number of complaints, but we can actually isolate what the complaint is about, whether it's from a provider or whether it's from a recipient, whether it is a payment issue, and maybe even what service line the complaint arose from. And here you have us slicing it based on what service line the complaint arose from. And not all complaints are created, or complaint levels are created equal. If you've got a service like physician services, where everybody in the program, all 3.2 million people, are potentially receiving physician services, and you have 50 complaints in a month, that's very different than 50 complaints in a month about home health services, where not a very large percentage of the people in the program are receiving home health services, so that'd be indicative of a larger problem. We also know that the plans in the program, and we can slice this data by plan and look at it that way, that not every plan is the same. If you have 50 complaints from a plan that has only 50,000 enrollees, that's not the same as having 50 complaints from a plan that has 800,000 enrollees. And we can look at it that way and look at the complaints per 1,000, and it gives us an insight into which plans are doing well, what regions are doing well, what service lines are the hottest points of emphasis. This has helped us identify all sorts of issues. In one particular instance, we have had, during the fall, a plan that was having trouble paying its providers in a timely fashion. We were able to identify that based on a spike in complaints from the complaint hub. That resulted in us ultimately freezing the enrollment of that plan, putting them under a corrective action plan. They have developed an emergency payment plan. They've been getting their payments to the providers. It does look like we're going to be able to lift that enrollment freeze toward the end of this month. So that's how the program is supposed to work. That's how the complaint process is supposed to work. Some word about where this is very effective and where it's not. If someone is not getting connected with the care they need, we often can, on the same day, try to get that problem resolved and can get that problem resolved. Recipient complaints have a much quicker resolution time than provider complaints, because provider complaints have to be studied to determine what went wrong and to determine what we can do about it. The Complaint Hub is, we are not the American Arbitration Association. We are not a judge or a jury. So if you have a contract dispute or a factual dispute with the plan, we're not the place that you resolve that fight. And we do get a lot of complaints there. Sometimes we can get the parties talking to each other, because we do inquire. If someone complains to us, we will inquire with the plans, and we can maybe grease the wheels to a resolution. But that's not necessarily the strength of this particular product. We also are not here to issue declaratory relief or to interpret your contract if it's a provider. That's also something we're not necessarily there to do well. So if a provider has a contractual dispute, we do not come in and say, well, we see your contract, and your contract means this, and therefore you have to pay. That's not something that this does well. Again, we get those complaints, and I think that complaining to us and getting us nosing around doesn't necessarily hurt from a provider perspective or from a plan perspective. Things can get resolved that way, but that's not the strength of this particular complaint and issue hub. This is really, I think, one of the core features of the new program. We had so many different programs we were running side by side in different geographic areas before. And now that we've combined all of those waivers and combined all of those delivery systems into one, it really has allowed us to create one central intake point, so that we have much better day-to-day fingers on the pulse of the program, so that we can identify problems quicker, put them out before they become too big, and really do have the tools in our contracts now, like I said, to do the enrollment freeze or to take big steps that really get a plan's attention in terms of fixing problems. I saw there was a question from the floor, so Mr. Snow, you're recognized.
Yeah, I wonder,
Chris Snow, Alliance of Florida PPEX and other clients. My question, pretty simple, is that tool available to the public to kind of slice and dice and look at it for their own interests, or the?
We report the information to the federal government, and it is broken down by plan and also by complaint type, so you could create that. I'm not sure that there's a tool out there that would specifically do that, but that's not a bad idea. And it's one that we are actively thinking about and hope to do sometime this year. We have made a concerted effort. You'll see some of the things that we've driven out publicly with respect to our encounter data. We have similar types of interactive sites available looking at our enrollment. And we do intend to put interactive capability on the complaints and the Complaint Hub as well in the coming year. It's part of what we call our Encounter in the Cloud project. And more information about the program is going to go out publicly available, where people can search it on their own, run their own HEDA scores, look at how the, you know, how well people are being connected with care by plan, by region, and look at our enrollment and understand our population a little bit better and understand what the hot spots are. Dr. Payne, you're recognized.
Robert Payne, just a comment about HEDIS scores.
Sure.
You know, I would hate that we would depend so heavily on the HEDIS scores, realizing the HEDIS scores are really heavily weighted toward encounters and heavily weighted toward the number of providers and networks, things like that. I would, if there's some kind of way, think a much more telling way of seeing you know, what care is rendered for the population and looking at CT codes. Because HEDIS scores can be misleading in the number of encounters. You have a lot of encounters, but have little work done.
Yeah. We're really focused on the preventive element of dentistry, and the HEDIS score that we're looking at is the annual dental visit. That is the one that goes into the report cards. We're thinking about, and certainly welcome a dialogue with you, with the Dental Association, of picking up a few more quality metrics around sealants and other things that you around preventive care that you think would be the most indicative of a high quality preventive dental program.
Thank you for that. But really, the comment had to do with all phases, you know, of medicine. I think we have to be careful when we just look at or look heavily at just encounters and number of providers and networks. Because we can be misled as how much treatment really is being rendered.
Yeah. As we get the encounters up in the cloud, the other things that we look at in terms of how effective we are at delivering care, we do want to look at preventive measures, and we do want to look at, I think you're right, HEDIS scores measure how well the plans are engaging in disease management, for example. You know, how many people with diabetes got this test, that test, the other test, what percentage of them during the course of the year. But we also want to make sure that folks aren't going unnecessarily to the hospital and being hospitalized. We want to make sure that they're not using the emergency department unnecessarily. And those are other things that we can look at with our encounter data, match that up with the HEDIS scores, and try to get a more complete picture of our program and how well people are getting connected with the right care, the right time, in the right place. Yeah. The suggested core quality measures from the federal government are not all HEDIS scores. Some of them are encounter data measures. Some of them come off of something called a 416 report. Some of them are CAP surveys, so the consumer satisfaction surveys. There's a basket of them. You can find them, I'm sure, online at the federal government's website. If not, we can try to get them to the committee, and you can look at them. They actually change them from time to time, and I'm certain would welcome input from our committee or from other interested stakeholders around the country. They will drop a measure as being a core measure and will add another from time to time and update us. We, by and large, try to track that. We look at that during the course of the year, and our policy and quality folks bring that to our attention and say that this measure has been dropped, and here's the reason why the feds dropped it. Do we want to drop it or not? These two have been added. These are the core measures added. Do we want to add them? We generally track that. Again, we want to have a shared definition of success, and I think that what you're going to find around the country is a drive toward a shared identity as a country with what constitutes a high-performing health plan, what constitutes a high-performing health system, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's Medicare, looking at various populations, what constitutes excellent health care for that population. And we're certainly committed to that here. Yes, Amy Guinan, recognized.
I was curious when you were speaking about the enrollment freeze, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that works. For instance, when a newly eligible Medicaid recipient comes in and say they go to the Choice Counseling website, is that plan no longer listed, or are they told, I guess, what are they told if that's the plan that they've decided they want to choose?
Whenever a plan is frozen, whenever a plan is frozen, when a recipient goes out to the Choice Counseling site, the plan does not show up as an active choice for the recipient.
And let me caveat they're frozen. Because we only have two plans in the panhandle, Region 1 and Region 2, and one of the plan that was frozen is one of the two plans in this region, you can't freeze them in Region 2. So they're frozen everywhere but Region 2.
You read my mind. That was a follow-up question. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if we had a suggestion to the legislature about how to amend the statewide Medicaid managed care statute, one thing we would suggest is that we combine Regions 1 and Region 2 and that we have at least three plans in that region because that would give us a little bit more flexibility. These plans that are in Region 2 are elsewhere. So we can freeze their enrollment, and we do have some sticks with them, but if it had ended up being a plan that was only in Region 2 or only in Region 1, we actually wouldn't have the ability to freeze their enrollment, and I think that's probably one of the most significant tools that we have to really compel compliance in rapid fashion.
Okay. And if I could just one more follow-up. So in a region, though, where the plan could actually be frozen or enrollment could actually be frozen and a recipient just for some reason did really want to be in that plan, however, when they've had to choose, it's frozen. Is there a time during that year before their open enrollment where they could choose that plan again?
As a general rule, the answer, I think, functionally is going to be yes.
Okay.
And the reason is that after you get into your plan, whichever one you ended up in, you have 120 days as a free agent, and we have yet to experience someone that's been frozen for 120 consecutive days. So someone could get there. I think this plan is not even going to be frozen quite for 60 days, ultimately. And we've had another plan freeze that I doubt will last more than, it'll probably be less than a month. So
And worst case scenario, maybe they could request good cause enrollment later on if it was after the 180 days.
We try to be flexible with that sort of thing and be reasonable with that sort of thing. If that plan really does fit their needs the best, if they contacted us, we'd help get them into that plan.
Okay, thank you.
Justin.
Dr. Moffitt, you're
yes.
recognized.
This is probably obvious to everyone, but the health plans charge is to right size utilization, like you said, and to make sure that beneficiaries get the right care at the right time. And in the process of cost control, there's so much focus on overutilization. It's important to remember that all of the health plans have an underutilization plan as well. Especially in a capitated environment, it's extremely important that providers and delivery systems that are using a capitated environment render all the services they're supposed to render. So we actually track these things very, very carefully. The HEDIS scores help us track underutilization, but it's not real time. It's a real big lag. The complaint hub is one of the best things that the health plans can use to real time track, because if something's going wrong, very often it'll bubble up in a complaint fairly quickly, and we can pivot to that and address it more quickly. So I just wanted to make the point that one of the HEDIS scores are about last year or maybe a little before that, and the Complaint Hub is a very real-time fluid measurement tool that we can use to look for underutilization.
That's a good point. Encounter data also comes in much quicker.
Yes.
And you'll see some of the encounter data tools when we looked at, we did a look at dentistry that's available online. We plan on adding more and more service categories to that to allow people to look online at how the plans are connecting people with services. HEDIS scores are lagged. The key thing about HEDIS scores, and the reason they're so important, is that they're independently audited. And everybody has waited for all of the claims run out and all of the claims to roll in. So it is definitely a look at the past, but it is a very complete and independently audited look at the past, so you really can see how the plan did in that year and then how it compares to other plans in the country, with, of course, the classic stock market caveat: past performance is no guarantee of future results, how good or bad. But it is a look at the past, and we do think that information is important for the people to come into our program to see how the plan has done in recent years, so they can make an educated guess, shopper's decision about which plan is going to be best for them. But we also want more real-time data, which we'll see a little bit more in the presentation. Our encounter data does come in quite a bit faster, but it is not necessarily independently audited. Claims get adjusted. Claims get, things happen to claims. And so it's not quite the same thing as an audited HEDIS score. Going on to the next slide, you can look at our HEDIS scores. I think it's, I've lost the numbers, but it's the chart with the HEDIS scores. You can look at our HEDIS score performance over time. These are the health plans that we've had in our program. This is not from a complete managed medical assistance year. HEDIS scores are done on a calendar year basis, but if you look at calendar year 2014, most of calendar year 2014, based on our rollout schedule, was in the MMA program. And so this does give us a look. I think one of the key things that it gives us a look at is how well the plans handled the transition into managed care and how well they handled the rollout. And what you can see is that 55% of the HEDIS scores, again, most of these are core measures for adults and for children, identified by the federal government, 55% of our measures are above the national average for Medicaid plans, and 10% are at the national average. We've had no year comparable to that. So that is the highest performing year for our health plans in the history of the Medicaid program. Gratifying to see, as we get into complete years where the entire year is the managed medical assistance plan. We do, our goal is for all of these scores to be at or above the national average, and there are carrots and sticks in our program that punish the plans for failing to get their scores at or above the national average, and rewards in terms of there are caps on the amount of profit that a plan is allowed to have in our program, and we raise those caps if they are able to hit certain quality metrics. So there are rewards for them and there are punishments for them, and we are committed to getting all of the scores at or above the national average. Worth mentioning also that in addition to the 65% of the scores that were at or above the national average, most of the scores that were not above the national average were improved over the prior year. So we were seeing almost all of the scores trending in the right direction. And we hope for continuous improvement, and certainly have made this a point of emphasis in our program that every year the plan is working toward getting the highest HEDIS score and giving the most appropriate care to the enrollees in the plan. Going on to the next slide, dental is of particular importance to us. I think it's been a sore point, an Achilles heel in our program in past years, and it's something that we want to make sure as we go into a comprehensive managed care benefit that includes dental, that dental does not get lost in the shuffle. That would be the major concern you have of carving dental in, is that it would become kind of a sideshow, a service that people would lose focus on as they tried to focus on hospitalization and physician services and pharmacy. We want to make sure that did not happen, and so we did make all of the plans have to engage in a dental performance project where they're trying to drive toward higher dental quality scores, and they all had to present those projects to us. They have been reviewed by our quality team and approved. We actually are still hoping to kind of beef some of those projects up, but those came out in the fall. The plans are starting to implement those, and hopefully we start to see higher and higher numbers. Over the years, particularly in the reform program, where we have all of these various years of audited HEDIS results, you do see that there has been a general rise in the number and percentage of kids that get an annual dental visit during the course of the year. It's still not quite at the national average, and it's not where we would like it to be. You can also see in red on this MMA program quality dental visit scores, you can see in red on the left-hand side MMA year one. It's 43.1%. And if you go to the next page, you'll see where we got that number. That is not an official HEDIS score, which is why we put it in red. HEDIS scores are done on a calendar basis. The HEDIS scores for calendar year 2015 are going to come out this summer, and they will be independently audited and verified. We, however, couldn't wait that long. So our program we rolled out statewide on August the 1st. And we measured from August the 1st to July the 1st and tried to look into our encounter data and calculate the HEDIS score the exact same way a HEDIS auditor would calculate. We calculated the numerator and the denominator exactly the same way. You had to be in a plan a certain number of consecutive months to end up in the denominator. And also to end up in the denominator, you had to be in the plan on a specific anchor date, which I believe was July the 31st. And if you did that, then you were going to be counted in the denominator, and then we looked at the percentage of those kids that had an annual dental visit. If you go into the next page, you can see the statewide numbers. All of the plans are listed there in the bar graph on the inset, and you can see Sunshine, the child welfare plan, had a 77% score, very high. Overall, most of the major general plans are in the 40 to 45% range, which is in line with a 43% score. I will caveat some of the lower scores by Magellan, Clear Health, and Positive. Those folks, they're running a specialty plan. That's a very high acuity population. And so there may be, if you adjusted for acuity, there may be some explanation for their scores. In addition, Positive in particular only had a handful of members that made it in the denominator. So they actually won't get a formal HEDIS score when HEDIS comes out. They didn't have enough people in the plan that would meet the score. That being said, if you only have 10 people, would it kill you to get five of them into the dentist? So we're kind of two minds on that. It's only five people. Let's see if we can get something out there, get them into the dentist's office. But nevertheless, if you look at this page and the next page, you can see some of the ways that we can break this down. You can see how we can break it down by region and really identify some of the hot spots in the program. And by the way, these are just screenshots. There's screenshots. This is an interactive program, and it is available online. So if you want to go into the into our website, we can give you all the link, and you can start to look and slice and dice this data a little bit to your own heart's content, figure out by plan and by region a lot of information about where a plan is doing well, where a plan's trouble spots are. Some of the things you might recognize as you go into the look at the next slide, you can see on Region 3, 34%. So it's pretty low. There needs to be a focus on getting folks into the dentist in that region. That's way below the statewide average. Region 2 is at the statewide average at 43%, but if you go back to the first page, you can actually look by county at where Region 2 is doing well and where it's not doing well, what you realize is that Tallahassee is a sore spot. Tallahassee and Gadsden County are a sore spot. Actually, the scores tend to be well above the national average in almost every other county in Region 2. So the plans that are in Tallahassee, if you click on the plan, you can actually see what their score is by county and figure out which plan is doing better than the other and really get down to a granular level of who's doing well and where they're doing well. And as I mentioned before, we are going to try to get more and more services out to the public with interactive features like this so that people can really take a look into the program on their own time, slice the data in their own way, ask questions about the program, and have their questions answered in a very public way. Are there any questions about this? Dr. Moffitt.
Just one comment. A lot of the conventional literature suggests that access to dental care is a lot more challenging in rural counties. So what you said about Region 2 is actually surprising and a real credit to the plans in those counties maybe Leon and Gadsden have the challenges, but the fact that the rural counties did well is a surprise and speaks flies in the face of what the conventional literature suggests about that. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Amy?
Justin, you said that this was on the ACA website right now?
It is.
Oh, I can't believe I missed
yeah.
it. Okay.
Yeah, it's been up for quite some time, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just under the Medicaid.
We can get you the link and the pathway to it.
Thanks.
Despite the fact that our website is the most user-friendly website imaginable, we will help. We'll help you find it. Right. I'm being very sarcastic. We're going to try to make our website a little bit easier to use as well, but because things can be very hard to find there. But we'll get you that link and that pathway, and you can get a much closer look. And this isn't just going to be limited to dental services. It will be all services. Dr. Payne?
Dr. Payne, in response to Dr. Moffitt's question about the rural counties, I think that's attributable to the effectiveness of the local county health departments, because that is where the vast, vast majority of the Medicaid services are being done.
Yeah, I think that it's worth mentioning also rural health clinics and county health departments that are definitely factoring prominently in those scores. All right, moving on to the next slide in the presentation, which is about the health plan report cards. As I mentioned before, we have broken down our program into baskets of quality measures that each pertain to a certain subject. The measures include pregnancy-related care, children's dental care, keeping kids healthy, that's for preventive care, keeping adults healthy, and then serving kids and serving adults with chronic conditions, as well as a mental health grade. And each of the plans get scored on those things, looking at a basket of HEDIS scores. If you go to the next page, it kind of gives you the pathway. This is actually on the FloridaHealthFinder.gov website, also publicly available. But this gives you the pathway to get to it. And if you go to the following slide, you can see a report card with all of the stars on it. You can actually click on, for example, pregnancy-related care. When you go up to the top, you'll see that bubbled in is the Medicaid Health Plan report card. You could bubble in pregnancy-related care, and it will go in and actually break down what the different elements are that are being scored in pregnancy-related care and how the plan did in each of those elements. And that will even give you the raw score. So if 80% of the people in the plan got a certain service, the 80% will pop up. So you can do it as stars, which will tell you whether or not it was above the national average or how close it was to the national average, or you can do it as the raw score and see what the plan scored. Our hope is that this becomes a more prominent feature in the choice process during the course of the year, and our thought is that we're open to insight about how to make this a little bit more user-friendly so that people can understand it a little bit faster And when they choose a health plan, that they are shopping based on quality, as well as based on the networks, as well as based on the service package. Any questions on this, the consumer report card? I am kind of partial to letter grades as opposed to stars, Medicare uses stars, so we've started out at least using stars. We may shift to letter grades because I do think that they're a little bit more understandable. It's very easy to tell. You definitely know what it means when someone gets an F and when someone gets an A. I think it has people have a stronger reaction to it, and it's easier to understand. All right. Shifting now to the consumer, what we call a CAP survey. This is another national tool, similar to HEDIS scores, where we are asking questions of our enrollees, questions about their own health if they're an adult on Medicaid, or questions about the health care that their children are receiving if they're a parent of a Medicaid child or Medicaid family. Surveying, we're entering the political season, so we know that the way that you ask questions and the order that you ask questions and the methodology that you use, whether it's cell phone or landline or whether it's online, can all make results vary. The beauty of a CAP survey is that it is a standardized national methodology, a standardized national questionnaire that yields a result that can once again be compared across health plans and around the nation. And what we have found, and this is an MMA score, unlike the HEDIS scores, which part of the year, it measured an entire calendar year, and part of the year was in MMA, and a little bit of the year was not. This is a CAP survey of people that were enrolled in MMA plans. This is an evaluation of the statewide Medicaid managed care program, and the initial numbers came back very strong, often stronger. The satisfaction levels were higher than commercial plans in the state when asked the same question. So when you look at parents, and some of the numbers we put here on the next slide, they show you how parents responded with respect to their kids' health care. When it came to their overall plan satisfaction on a 10-point scale, 81% of parents rated the child's health plan an 8, a 9, or a 10 on a 10-point scale. When it came to, say, the question, do you usually, always, sometimes, or never find it easy to get care? 82% of them said that they usually or always find it easy to get care, and 89% of them said they usually or always find it easy to get care quickly. You can see that the satisfaction with the providers was also high, with them saying that their doctor usually or always explains things to them well. And so we're very gratified by that. You'll see a very high rating also when people were asked to rate their personal doctor. 90% of them rated their personal doctor an 8, 9, or a 10. Those are gratifying numbers. Many of them are above the national average. Many of them are above the national average for CHIP plans. Many of them, like I said, are above the national average for commercial plans, as well as above the average for commercial plans here in the state. So the satisfaction levels with the program do appear to be fairly high.
Preston?
Yes.
I had a quick question. It's just a little pet peeve with statistics in the sense.
Yeah. Somebody has just put us on hold, would be my guess. And so we're getting their hold music, which is nowhere near as good as the governor's hold music. If you would like to call the governor's office to be put on hold, I think you'll find yourself to be pleasantly surprised. You will not be disappointed. Just call up and ask them to put you on hold for a minute and see what happens.
So it's just a little pet peeve in terms of statistics in regards to the surveys and respondents is just a raw score, you know, either how many respondents were there in order to create that percentage or what percentage of enrollees responded, like that, to get a
When I say that there's a standardized methodology, you'll see different methodologies from different pollsters in the political realm, and you'll see 587 registered voters said this and 580 likely voters said that, and how you define likely voter can affect what the survey result is. The CAP survey does control for that. They do have to get at least 3,000 respondents to the measure, okay? And it's 1,650 parents and 1,350 adults have to respond. So at least 3,000 people have to respond. If you have less than that in your plan, you have to poll everybody. Right? So you get to kind of a standardized margin of error, And you really can compare over time. Now, if it's 81 one year and 82 the next, you can say that that's within the margin of error of the poll. It's probably the same thing. But if it's 81 one year and 87 the next, or 81 one year and 73 the next, you can start to say that, well, one is there's definitely been movement here, and it does appear to be significant because it's the same question being asked in the same way with the exact same methodology. I mentioned a little bit about exceeding the Kid Care Consumer Satisfaction Survey, that the MMA plans did score above the national Medicaid benchmark and the national CHIP benchmark for overall health care experience with their primary care providers, and experience with their specialty care providers. So we're gratified by that, and we are going to be watching that as those numbers move forward. With respect to the long-term care program, this program serves about 90,000 people in the state of Florida, provides long-term services and supports. By and large, this population does not receive medical care from the Medicaid program. They receive medical care from the Medicare program. The supports and services that they receive here are supports that allow them to age in place. It could be things like home modifications, people that come in and help them with their activities of daily living, like bathing, dressing, and eating. It could be chore workers, things that allow them to age in place and support them, but are not necessarily medical in nature. Here, quality is a little bit harder to define. We've been working with our federal government on new measures and ways of thinking about quality in the long-term care arena. But one way that we look at it is we once again have a patient satisfaction survey, and we look at our success in transitioning people out of institutional settings or diverting people from institutional settings and keeping them in home and community-based settings. And we've tried to set our rates in a way that incentivizes that shift, so that we pay the plans a certain capitation payment for folks in the nursing home, but then we take back a certain very small percentage of that money, so that if they really want to have the best margin that they can have in our program, they need to transition a certain percentage of their population across from the nursing facilities and into the community. And the law itself actually directs us to do that. And if you look at the following page, you can see the number of enrollees. You can see where the population was located on this bar chart. When we started the program, or when we first looked at the program back in July of 2014, there were about 39,000 people being served in the community versus 43,000, almost 44,000 served in nursing facilities. Exactly 1 year later, those numbers had virtually flipped, and we had slightly more people being served in the community than we had being served in nursing facilities. So it does appear that those incentives worked. And if you look at it on a plan level, which you can see in this chart here, you can see that every single plan had that same experience. So the way that we set the rates and set the incentives in the program does appear to be working with respect to getting people into the community. Every plan year over year from 2014 to 2015 saw a shift and a higher percentage of its population at the end date in the community versus in a facility. So that's one good piece of news. When it comes to the LTC enrollee satisfaction survey, moving on to the next slide, this is something that the agency had to design, so that it's asked in a standardized way each year. There's no CAP survey on this, so we had an agency tool that asked, and we did use independent survey vendors to do it, and all of the plans were required to do it, and the survey was completed in 2015, and we have isolated on one page, I think it's page 40, one thing that really stood out to us, which is that 77.4% of the people in the long-term care program reported that their life, that their quality of life had improved since enrolling in their long-term care program. And just to break that number down, I have some sub-numbers here. 30.6% of the people in the long-term care program reported that their life, the quality of life had improved a lot since enrolling in their long-term care plan. And 46.8% had reported that it had improved a little. The total is 77.4%. So a huge percentage of the population reporting significant improvement in their lives or some marginal improvement in their lives as a result of the rollout of this program. You look on the next page, you'll see another interesting set of numbers. I'll direct you to the one at the bottom. We don't provide health care in this particular program. Medicare, by and large, does. But you'd expect if people got the chore work and got the personal care assistance that they needed and had someone coming in and engaging with them every day, that that might yield some positive benefit on the health side for that individual. And in fact, nearly 60% of the enrollees in the program reported that their overall health had improved since enrolling in their long-term care plan. Florida State University did an independent evaluation of the program, and they actually did find that there were, when it came to things like falls, when it came to things like ulcers, that whether you were in a community, an assisted living facility, or a home setting, there did appear to be small gains in the health of the recipients that were enrolled in the long-term care program. So that's gratifying to see as well, and certainly something that we want to see continue in the future. Okay. Express enrollment. Do you want to give an update on express enrollment? I guess we have tried to accelerate the pace at which someone gets into a managed care plan in our program, and we call it express enrollment. Before, if you got into if you came into the Florida Medicaid program and were determined eligible, let's say at the beginning of January, you would not have gone into your managed care plan until February the 1st. We wanted to shorten that time period and get the enrollees into their managed care plan as soon as, maybe even on the date of their determination of eligibility, because the plans offer more services than we offer under statewide Medicaid managed care. They offer over-the-counter products, they offer an expanded outpatient benefit, they offer additional physician visits. So we really wanted to make sure that we got people into the care coordination model of the plans and the expanded benefits of the plans as quickly as we could. And we were able to do that. We got a permission from the federal government through an amendment to the waiver during the fall. It's been implemented this month. People are going in. I believe it's the day after they are determined eligible that they go into. It's the day of. So the day that they are determined eligible, they go into their managed care plan. That does not mean that all fee-for-service disappears. When you're determined eligible, you're sometimes determined eligible retroactively. So it's only from the date of the determination forward that you go into the managed care plan. The managed care plan really can't coordinate all the services that you received in the 60 days prior or 30 days prior or whatever date you were determined eligible on. So that still becomes a fee-for-service period. But the person from the day they're determined eligible has access to the additional adult dental benefit, for example, and all of the outpatient and physician benefits and over-the-counter benefits that are available in the plan. With respect to providers, we are working on streamlined credentialing as well, and we have made a significant stride in that respect, which we made in December. We're trying to get the process of getting enrolled and credentialed with our agency as a Medicaid provider and with the plans to be more of a one-stop shop. The idea that you don't have to go through the credentialing process with multiple different plans. We made a significant step forward in that regard in December, and you can see that described here. It's on slide 44. We have an express type of credentialing process where we will issue you a Medicaid provider ID after you have done limited enrollment with us, and you don't have to go on with us to continue to get fully enrolled, but that Medicaid provider ID is critical because then you can go to the health plan with that Medicaid provider ID and it will help you expedite the enrollment process with them. If you want to be a fee-for-service provider in our program, you do have to still go through the full enrollment process. This limited enrollment, if you don't want to go on and do the full enrollment, that's fine, but that means that you're only going to be ultimately using that Medicaid ID to expedite your enrollment and your credentialing with the health plans. If you don't do full enrollment, you're not going to be able to do services in the fee-for-service system. Any questions about any of these things?
Justin?
Yes. Amy, you're recognized.
Thank you. Just on the express enrollment issue, you mentioned how recipients have the opportunity to make the plan choice concurrent with the eligibility application, and I think before this rolled out, my understanding was that as people are applying through Access, when the application is complete, then there might be something that pops up that gives them an opportunity to go to the choice counseling link, or my question is, how is that working?
Damon Rich. What happens is exactly as you explained, is they get a pop-up link where they can click on that link through a document called What's Next on the DCF website. It will take them to the Choice Counseling website where they can make a plan selection that is held in the system, until their eligibility comes through and is approved.
Okay, great. And just one follow-up, if I may. Then, as recipients are deciding, if they don't decide that day, then they'll be assigned one, but they can still have the 3 months or the 90.
Actually, no.
Okay.
Okay. Before you had 30 days to choose your plan, and then after you were chosen, or it was you chose it, or it was chosen for you, you had 90 days. What we've done now is we have, because you don't have 30 days in advance to choose it, we're giving you 120 days after you're put into the plan to choose another one. So you don't have a 90-day open enroll kind of free agency period. You now have a 120-day free agency period.
Great, thank you.
Yes, Jenny. Jenny Wang recognized.
I know it's only been a week, and I haven't gotten a lot of feedback on this, but have y'all gotten feedback on how it's working?
Damon Rich. Yes, it is. So far, things are going really well. We're not receiving any complaints from any of the recipients. Recipients are actively going out and making choices. Recipients are enrolling, being auto-assigned otherwise. We've not had a chance to look at any trending data with regards to people who call in to make a change after being auto-assigned. Since we're just a week in, we'll look at that data within the next few days to kind of determine that, but we're not hearing complaints. We have noticed a couple of items around newborn that we just need to work through. But other than that, even those are not proving to be huge issues.
When we rolled out the program, the headline number of people that chose their plan was about 33%. We knew the actual number was a little bit higher than that, because some people were in a plan before statewide Medicaid managed care that they had chosen, and they remained in that plan after statewide Medicaid managed care rolled out, and they did not show as choosers. So we knew the number was higher than that. As our program has some legs underneath it, and as the time has passed, a higher and higher percentage of people are showing up as having chosen, and we actually have passed the 50% level. We probably expected to drift up to about 70%. We'll be interested to see how this affects it, because we really want this to be something that drives more people choosing as opposed to fewer. And really, while they're thinking about their health care, while they're signing up, that's when they go and can shop and make the choice, and we'll have more choosers. So we will be tracking that over time, and we hope that the way that the number of people and percentage of people that are in a plan that they have actively chosen, we hope that continues to drift upward and that this doesn't interrupt that kind of forward march that we were seeing.
Thank you. This is Abby Riddle. I'll add, in the first 4 days, we had 14,000 successful enrollments with express enrollment.
Which brings me to the last slide. There's been a lot in the news media talking about the overall expense of our program and how it keeps going up. And the reason that the program continues to go up as an overall, in terms of its overall cost, is largely because we have had significant increases in enrollment over the last several years. It is normal for the Medicaid program to see spikes in enrollment during economic downturns and then to see enrollment level off when the economy picks back up. However, during this particular economic recovery, I think that it's fair to say that the opening of the exchanges has led to a significant number of people going onto the exchange, asking about buying health care and learning of their Medicaid eligibility. And so we are seeing a number of eligible but not enrolled people showing up in our program, and our roles are still growing even though we're in the midst of an economic recovery. The enrollment on the exchange in Florida has been at very high levels, extraordinary levels. I think it probably will be a little bit higher this year than it was last year. It was quite a bit higher last year than it was the first year. We've had some of the highest activity, really, on the exchanges in terms of people purchasing health insurance on the exchanges in Florida, and that has led to a spike in our enrollment. However, the overall cost of the program in terms of per member per month have been going down. And that's very important to understand. With statewide Medicaid managed care, we were required to get 5% per member per year savings year over year. We do believe that we got that. You'll see a little bit of a hump here in fiscal year 2013 and 2014 where it looks like there was a bit of a spike. In fact, that is a feature of a managed care rollout and a shift from fee-for-service to managed care. And in July 1st of 2014, for example, we started prepaying for all of the medical care for our enrollees in Miami. And at the same time in July of 2014, we were paying for all of the fee-for-service claims in June. And so you end up having to pay kind of twice for a Medicaid program, and you will see a little bit of an initial spike in costs associated with shifting people from fee-for-service, where claims are paid from the past, into a prepaid system, because you do for 60, 90 days, you are paying for two Medicaid programs at once. Overall, though, then, you see that the number starts to really dip, and you see the savings associated with the program in fiscal year 2015-16, and that is what this shows. It's been dropping the entire decade, and the key here is we're trying to get higher quality scores without driving inflation, and so far the initial returns seem to be good. Are there any questions about that? All right, am I next on the agenda as well? Who wrote this agenda? Okay. Next up, there's another thing in your materials here, the quarterly statewide Medicaid managed care report. As part of our agency's reorganization, we've had to kind of reorganize our functions and reorganize our programs so that we are centered on running a managed care system and on overseeing contracts that we have with health plans, as opposed to running the various systems that we had before. Part of that is we have been trying to beef up our business intelligence and our data analytics capabilities and get a better understanding in real time of our program. And we have an entire business intelligence unit that we have founded with a statistician at its head who is taking quarterly looks at our program. The idea is that we are going to be able to do some ad hoc looks at our program, but also we are going to be able to do things on an annual basis, repeat reports each quarter where we give the updated information and can start trending information over time. And there is a wealth of data in these. These are available online at our very difficult to navigate website, to be fair. We're trying to improve that. And you can go into these reports. They're definitely worth reading. Lots of interesting stuff about our program in these reports. Very worthwhile to read. When it comes down to it, we're on the Medical Care Advisory Committee. No one should know more about this program than we do. And this is an opportunity to really get into the nuts and bolts and understand the population, understand the plan profiles, understand where the population's being served, understand the services that they're utilizing. Starting off, the first report came out at the end of January of 2014, and we have now four reports up and online. There's going to be a winter report, a spring report, a summer report, and a fall report each year. The first one looked at our long-term managed care program because that was the program that had the most data behind it, and looked at a little bit with respect to the MMA program in terms of enrollment and implementation and demographics. When you look at the next slide, you can see some of the things in there. The statistician does an excellent job of portraying things graphically so that you can understand. You know, you can see some of the market share here when it comes to the general plans, as well as when it comes to enrollment in the specialty plans. When you look at the demographics on the page after that, you can see it presented in a different way, the number of enrollees, what the ages are of those enrollees, and where the population really resides. You'll see, for example, something we probably already all knew, which is that by and large, but this really helps you see it graphically, we serve kids. It's a very young population in our program. Hundreds of thousands of kids in each of the age groups, 1 through, 0 through 10. And that's where the bulk of our population is. When it comes to the long-term care program, the profile is of someone who's a frail elder in their early 80s, and you can see that too. You can see that goes all the way out to 108. It's interesting. You can look at our encounter data as well, and you can, when you look at our enrollment, because our enrollment numbers are online too, interactive, kind of like the dental thing that you saw, that we do have folks, quite a few folks over the age of 100 in our program, which is interesting to see. They're in our long-term care program. Looking at the payments, you'll see that the payment ranges there on the next slide. That was really, we hadn't quite fully rolled out the statewide Medicaid managed care program, so the full capitation payments for the medical assistance plans hadn't been made, which is why those payments look so low. Overall, it's about a $15 billion, $16 billion chunk of the Medicaid program goes into the statewide Medicaid managed care program, so it's very large. You can go down to the next slide, which shows you all of the issues and complaints. And you get a narrative description, which each of these as well, in the report. When you go to the summer report, some of the highlights, you can look at the enrollment of the MMA population, you can look at each plan's market share, the services that people are getting, the issues and complaints that we were seeing, as well as looking at those same things with respect to the long-term care plan. You can see in the next slide, which goes into enrollment in the MMA program, you can see how it drifted up. We had full statewide implementation in August of 2014, but the population within managed care slowly started to pick up after that. We now have about 3.1 million people in the managed care plans at any one time. We do expect that to go up slightly again as a result of express enrollment. So little tweaks into as to how fast we got people into plans started to affect these numbers and drive the number a little bit higher, our fee-for-service population dropping. When you go into the interactive thing on our website, what you realize is that of the people that truly get their Medicaid benefits from the get their health care benefits from the Medicaid program and that who are voluntary for managed care, there are only about 35,000 people that have opted out of the managed care program and received their services on a fee-for-service basis in the traditional Medicaid program. 3.1 million people receive it in the managed care plans. An additional about 100,000 have third-party liability, so that it's a small percentage of our population, about 1 or 2%, that have actually access to private insurance. And so while they are technically eligible for Medicaid, they get their services through private insurance plans. So only 35,000 people really, truly in the fee-for-service system, which is interesting to know. You can see the enrollment by plan. She really does a great job. Her name is Lori Reed. She does a great job of parsing the data, really getting into some of the nitty-gritty and understanding how people are being served. You can see the long-term care program enrollment. I'm going to fast forward here to the you can see before I go to the autumn 2015 that 94% of long-term care enrollees received at least one service during the review period. Because they're on Medicare, sometimes nursing facility stays and things like that can be paid for by the Medicare program as well as home health. So sometimes people will disappear off the radar for a period of time as they receive services through the Medicare program. But overall, the overwhelming percentage of the population was receiving services through the program. When we did the autumn 2015 report, we started to really look at where the people were being served in the long-term care program and how that was changing over time. We also wanted to look at participant direction. The people in that program have the opportunity to hire their own workers and caretakers and to hire and fire them and make those payment decisions. And we wanted to see how many people were taking advantage of that option. As you go into these slides, you will see where the population was residing over time and how successful the plans were in transitioning enrollees from nursing facility services into home-based services. And you also get an idea of, in the participant direction option, it's actually a lightly used service, but it's one that has been growing steadily over time. So we would anticipate more and more people will be using the participant-directed option as they learn about it, as they become familiar with it, as they figure out how to get started with it. And this gives them the ability to hire a family member or someone very trusted, a friend or something like that, to provide their personal care assistance, to provide some of their chore work and home care so that they can stay and age in place. Finally, the most recent one has just come out, lots of great information in here. One of the things that it shows is how many people started MMA and shift to fee-for-service, or how many people are in fee-for-service who then shift to managed care, and you can see where the population is being served, very worthwhile. Takes one of the first looks at finance. If you look at, go a couple pages ahead to MMA financial expenditures, you will see, you know, the total revenue, and you can see their operating margin a couple pages later, that most of them had a bad year in the first year of the program, that their operating margin was negative. However, there appears to be an almost direct correlation between their hospital expenditures and their operating margin. So that the plans that had the highest expenditures on hospitals, and it might have been their hospital contracting levels or their ability to keep people out of the hospital or a combination of both, but there's a really strong correlation between a plan spending a lot of money in the hospital in the first year and a plan having a negative operating margin. Any questions about these plans? I encourage everyone to go online. You can print these out. We can get you hard copies if you'd like it. And these come out regularly on a quarterly basis, so look for them each quarter. You can learn a lot about the program from these reports. Dr. Payne.
Did not the legislature approve a 7% increase in the amount of funds going to these companies? And is that reflected in this profit and loss graph?
It is not reflected in the graph because this is from a time period before that increase went into effect. The increase itself is a projection, which is hard to gather. But the way that the actuaries set the rates, there's not one monolithic rate in a region. Because we risk adjust our rates and we have rate cells across the board, a plan gets paid a different rate for someone with HIV/AIDS, for example, than they would for someone that doesn't have HIV/AIDS. They get paid a different rate for a newborn gets paid a different rate than someone who a healthy 10-year-old. And there are rate cells across the board based on age and based on some of the conditions or flags that the person has in terms of diagnoses. And the rates, each rate cell gets changed based on the market conditions, and the actuaries try to set the rates in a way where they feel that the amount of money that a plan is going to receive is reasonable to achieve its purpose. If we had the exact same population at the time that the actuaries said this is the rate increase, if you had the exact same population mix the following year, it would have been about a 7% increase. What we actually saw is that the population coming onto Medicaid subsequent to that statement was healthier than you might have expected. They were families as opposed to disabled adults, and those rate cells hadn't gotten as much of an increase as some of the other ones, and so the average that the started to erode, it went down. I want to say to somewhere in the low sixes. I'm not an actuary, so I tried to explain that to you the best that I could, but even these rate increases, because there are so many different rate cells, it really depends on, nobody is going to get that exact rate increase that the actuaries are predicting. It's going to depend on what population they have and what regions they're in, because every region had a different average rate increase.
I guess the question I'm asking is a simpler question. You know, if you see all these companies losing money, and was that why the legislature granted them a rate increase? And was this were these figures compiled before the rate increase took effect?
These figures were compiled before the rate increase took effect, and this report didn't come out until after the legislature had already taken action and after the actuaries reviewed the rates. It's not unusual to see a loss in the first year of a program. Because the plans come in and they have to reach out to their members, and they're entering into new contracts with providers in a footprint in a geographic areas where they haven't had it before, so there's a lot of startup costs associated with it. I think the thing that we spotted in our data, and it really was backed up by the actuaries as they were setting the rates, is that the rates being paid to hospitals were way out of line with the assumptions that the plans had made during the competitive procurement process as to what they were going to pay hospitals. And then when you look at how much each plan was expending on hospitals and see that there's a direct correlation to how much you're spending on hospitals to whether to what your operating margin was, you start to get a clearer picture of why the plans were struggling in the first year. I think, yes, there were a number of issues associated with, hey, it's a new program and there are startup costs associated that you wouldn't expect going forward, And I think that the other part of it was is that the hospital contracts were way higher than the plans had anticipated during the course of the first year. Now, our understanding is the plans have had quite a bit of success in renegotiating those hospital contracts and in getting them closer to the levels that they had assumed in their competitive procurement. So we'll be interested to see how this starts to play out over time. This is just baseline data. Okay. That we will move on to the next thing on the agenda, statewide Medicaid managed care complaints and compliance. And David Rogers is out of town, so I think it'll be you, Abby, doing this one?
Damon.
Both
of us.
Okay. Go ahead, Damon.
Thank you, Damon Rich. So we're just looking at complaints. You have the monthly complaint summary for you in for December of 2015. Just really want to kind of point out a few things that are with regard to the report itself. There are a total of 938 complaints for the month of December. But I want to really dive into some comparisons that you will not see on your document there, but just want to draw a few things. The majority of our complaints that come into our into the agency, the majority of them come in via the our call center, and the remainder of them come in through our online forms. And so just through this second quarter of this fiscal year, October of 2015, we had 656 of our complaints came in through our online form in October. That tipped up at December to 675. And through our helpline staff, it was 734 in October, and that ticked up to 775. But we are seeing more of our complaints start to come in through our call center, more so than our online form. Just to give a little bit of context for the first half of the fiscal year, for the month of July through September, first quarter, our top three issues that we had come in for complaints were payment, services, and network access. That has shifted in the second quarter to payment, services, and actual customer services. So our network access issues are actually on the decline as it relates to the complaints and issues that come in. The payments represent about 40% of our total complaints, and services, which encapsulates several different issues, but the one I'll highlight here is the transportation. And the first quarter of the fiscal year, transportation issues represented about 25% of the complaints. That is now on the downtick in the second quarter to 21%. So we're seeing a slow, gradual decrease in transportation-related complaints. For the most part, that is complaints in a nutshell in terms of what we have going on in terms of our trends and our issues that are over the first two quarters of this year. Any questions?
Damon, I had a quick question about not enough providers. This is under network access. No providers of a specific type or not enough providers of a specific type. And StayWell seems to stand out, and actually StayWell is one of the providers in my region, which is here in Region 2. And that's certainly a problem that I experience as an individual, you know, provider. But so when we have that complaint, what can we do? How's that being approached?
Okay. So there are a number of things that we as an agency undertake or do when that type of complaint comes in. We have one of the most improved views into our networks that we've probably ever had in terms of being able to monitor, know who the actual providers are, and see what a plan's network actually looks like. So one of our first steps is to review not only how many providers they have, but how many providers are actively accepting new recipients. We do that through a number of ways, not only looking at the reporting, but we engage in secret shopper activities to determine if what the plan is reporting to us lines up to what is the actual experience of the recipient. When we are, and you're going to hear Abby Riddle talk about compliance, when we find that to be the case, where they are not meeting either their network access standards or they are not accepting, have enough providers accepting, because there is a service level agreement around that as well, then we go into compliance mode, which may be some type of a liquidated damage, including, as Justin had laid out earlier, freezing the plan until we get that issue rectified.
It's worth mentioning as well that the plans are not all the same size. So StayWell is by far the largest plan, and that can sometimes lead them to have the highest volume of complaints, even though if you looked at it on a per-member basis, they're closer to being in line with the other plans. I don't know that they're so big that they're not enough providers of a specific type number would be adjusted all the way down. So I think you got a fair point. But it is important. It's not as out of line as maybe it looks, given the size.
Thank you for that. And the other thing, as I was listening, I was kind of thinking, well, what about a plan that's, you know, in more than one region? So it's hard to tell on this particular graph. I'm just staying with StayWell, not trying to pick on them, but if StayWell is in region 2 and whatever region, those are all those complaints in region 2 or... you know, all the regions that they do represent.
This is Abby Riddle. So we have internal reports that break these numbers down where we can look regionally and by provider type and specialty. So when we go to look at these issues, we can see trends that way. It's just not on this report.
Unfortunately, we would not be able to freeze StayWell in region 2 if we had a problem because there are only 2 plans.
Right, you know, so, you know, it's just near and dear to my heart. I mean, these are the plans that I would deal with, you know, in this region. So all I can ask is if you can't break those down, that if you're aware of that, if you're aware of that breakdown and you see a pattern, then that's something that, you know, I would hope you'd bring to our attention. So thanks.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm Abby Riddle. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about complaints to compliance and give you an overview of some compliance actions we've taken over the past quarter. So just to give you a brief overview of the way complaints to compliance works, my bureau is in charge of the contracts with the plans. We are the compliance hub, if you will. There's several internal reports that we use to monitor compliance. Complaints being one of them. We have several provider network reports, Medicaid Fair Hearing reports. I could go on and on. So weekly, we review all of these reports. Some of them are pulled monthly. We meet as a group every week, and we go over any compliance allegations made by other operational units within the agency. Then those are analyzed, and if we could substantiate a compliance action, we take that action. So I wanted to bring to the group this spreadsheet that you should have in your packet. What we've learned is maybe some of our internal tracking tools are great for us, but probably not the best for external use. So I wanted to bring this today to show you how we track, and we are going to work on refining how we get something out to the public in the spirit of transparency. Our goal is to have something out on our website that we will update monthly. So on this spreadsheet, you will see only final actions. And what I mean by that is the plans have an opportunity to appeal any contract action we take upon them. So what you will see on this spreadsheet is only those that are final or closed. Attached to this, you will see a breakdown that has greater detail of all of the both open and closed. And I wanted to point out a couple in response to some complaint trends we saw over the last quarter. So Damon talked a little bit about service-related complaints on transportation. We saw a spike in those complaints in the first quarter, fiscal quarter of 15-16, and we worked really hard with the plans to address those issues, and we did end up taking contract action against four plans, including liquidated damages and corrective action plans. And again, it's in the detail is in the back of your packet. Damon also mentioned customer service in regards to provider network. In November, we worked with an advocacy group in Florida that had identified inaccurate provider network reporting on their website, inaccurate information. We worked with them, and we found that for adult psychiatrists in Miami-Dade County, plans were not accurately reporting contact information and accurate networks. So we took contract action against 12 plans, liquidated damages, and caps again.
The advocacy group is Florida Legal Services. So thank you, Amy. Yes. And that was a big assist to us in terms of the secret shopping in that area. And what we were finding was that psychiatrists that were listed in network, when you tried to contact them, were not calling people back and were not answering the phone. And so whether they were in network or out of network, they were of very little use to the recipients and enrollees in the plans. And it was happening on a very broad basis. We took that data to the plans and confronted them with it. All of the plans took that data and tried to replicate what Florida Legal Services had done, and all of them confirmed Florida Legal Services findings. And so they are now in the process of going through talking to their providers and making sure that the providers are answering the phone and meeting customer service requirements of their own, so that the networks really are real from an adult psychiatry standpoint down in Miami-Dade County. Our hope is that they learn something and that we can all be proactive and make sure that around the state that type of thing is not occurring on a large scale.
Thanks, Justin. And we'll also be repeating that secret shopper exercise ourselves at the beginning of February. And then lastly, I wanted
Abby,
to mention...
Can I sure. interrupt you? On the secret service type of thing, and someone's contacting the office, but no one's calling back. And so what kind of information is being left on there? I guess I'm curious to know, if we identify as a consumer that, yes, I've got a Medicaid plan, or I'm on a certain Medicaid plan, I'd like to make an appointment, or did some of the secret shoppers just say, I'm a potential patient, you know, and would you call me back? And I'm just kind of wondering if there's a difference in that, you know,
I think a lot of it depends on who's calling. So in some of the secret shopping, we don't make it so secret we're the agency. We call and we say we're the agency, we're performing a regulatory exercise to make sure the plan's networks are in line, and we don't pretend. We take the secret out of it. When the plans call, I would imagine it's a little bit different, and they're making sure that their network is in place. But the exercise that Florida Legal Services did, they did say that they were a potential patient.
They were once again very standard in the way that they made their phone calls and the way that they approached the issue, so that they got standardized results across the board. Which also allows it to be replicated, frankly. That's one of the keys. They were very disciplined in documenting what they did and how they did it, and so we can see whether there's been improvement over time.
Yeah, I think that's great. It was just a kind of a curiosity from my point is whether or not they may call back if it was a different type of insurance, you know? It was just a curiosity, making a judgment one way or another.
Yeah, you don't know. And the way that they answered that one or asked that one, we may not know. I suppose it can be done different ways. And if we start to hear that that's a major problem, we may start doing some of that on our own. We certainly would encourage Florida Legal Services to do more if they would like to. I don't know how many resources they have to do it, but it's also our intention to do secret shopping going forward. So if they want to bring their boots to the ground, that's great. We're going to be bringing our resources to bear on it and hope to have good results. Sometimes we've had some complaints, for example, about providers and their disabled access at their facilities. It doesn't matter whether you're a Medicaid recipient or not. If you have no way of getting in a wheelchair into that office, there's an issue there. And we've had complaints around that. Whether these providers would have called someone back if they said they had private insurance or not, we don't know. But it shouldn't matter to us. From our standpoint, the Medicaid networks have to be real.
And just real quick, the last one I was going to bring up was the claims processing. So we did see an uptick in the first quarter of fiscal 15-16 with claims. We did have an issue with one plan, as Justin mentioned, and that plan has been frozen. And we took liquidated damages and we did a cap. So those are just some highlights. I will say for the next quarterly meeting, we're going to refine this report with a suggested report that we're going to put out on our website every month. So look forward to working with you all on that.
Jenny, you're recognized.
Thank you. First, I just wanted to say this is a lot of data and a lot of information, so I want to thank the agency for giving it to us and putting it on the website, because I really do think this is helpful and a lot of work. Thank you. And then I have a question, which I probably should know, and I just don't.
Sure.
On the last handout on the non-monetary and monetary actions, what's the difference between a sanction and a liquidated damage fine in those columns?
Oh, I used to be a lawyer. Thank you. Maybe Amy could give the answer. No, I won't put you on the spot. Liquidated damages, behind that is the idea that it's not a punishment. That we are entering into a financial arrangement with the plans where we are paying them a certain amount of money to do certain things. And if they fail to do those things, we have this giant grid of how much money we're just going to take back because you didn't do what we paid you to do, therefore we're not paying you to do it anymore. And we take the money back from them, and that's a liquidated damage. And it's not something, obviously the plan feels it, and it's something that we would use to try to get them to do the things we want them to do. But in theory, it's just a purely financial transaction where we paid you to do X, you did X minus one, so we're taking our one back. The sanction is a punishment. And so if a plan is going to go into another state or into our state next time in the competitive procurement and they're asked the question, as they always are, have you ever been sanctioned in another state for something you've done, they have to list the sanctions and the times they've been sanctioned by the states. So it is a contractual punishment as opposed to a financial transaction.
And the grand prize winner is Prestige with $145,000.
Yes. Do we want to, we are just over time, I think. Do we want to push the bylaw discussion to the next meeting?
Yeah, we don't have a quorum anyway, so we couldn't vote on the changes we were making to the
okay.
bylaws. So.
Okay.
Is it appropriate for me to ask a question about the bylaws real quick for next time?
Sure.
With apology. In red, I'm sorry, Kathy Moffitt. Article 2, Section 1. In red, one of the items for consideration is that past beneficiaries must have received Medicaid benefits within the last 2 years. And my question is, we historically have had some former beneficiaries that may be aging out of that requirement, but because of their expertise or their advocacy in certain, particularly special populations, I, for one, think that we would be losing something if we just out of hand lost their participation. Does the agency have any latitude in those cases to keep them on, or Is this pretty firm language? Just a question.
We would probably have to discuss our latitude with the federal government.
Okay.
You know, we agreed in our waiver. We had a lot of discussions around this, and we both wanted to get more consumer engagement on the advisory committee. And we increased the number of people on the advisory committee who had to be Medicaid recipients, so we got some of the recipient experience.
Okay.
That being said, people go into and out of eligibility. They might fall off of eligibility. If they're on the committee, what happens then? That question wasn't answered. So I think this is really just our attempt to try to put some parameters around, okay, you're not eligible anymore. We have to have a certain number of members who are Medicaid eligibles on the committee. What does that mean? And that's what we're trying to do here. I think that's open for discussion. We certainly don't mind having more enrollee representation than the minimum.
Okay.
And so we can discuss that.
Okay, thank you.
So if we could move the last two items to the agenda for the next meeting.
Okay, and the next meeting is tentatively scheduled for April 19th, 2016. Any other comments or questions? We'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow.